This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/JoelDuggan to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 156 for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me tonight, Mr. Brockett Vola is back. Welcome back, sir.
Hello, hello. I'm ready for another hour of geography talk. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's funny how, because I don't have like weekly guests on the show, it's like monthly, you know, people tend to come by every like 4 to 6 weeks, give or take. There's always this kind of bit of catch up, and it's so hard to avoid really boring small talk that doesn't apply to listeners. Like, oh, I don't know, the weather, and where we're from. And like, unless it's someone new and they're from somewhere really bizarre, you know, when Brian Dunaway was on the show. He's from South Carolina, and I've never had, you know, him on the show or anybody from that region on the show before. So it was always kind of nice to kind of hear his perspectives about stuff. It's difficult when you get into like having people on, but not every week, because you feel like you want to catch up with everybody.
Right. I gotcha. Yeah, totally.
That's kind of funny.
We have Kyle and I on my podcast, Biggest Fan Podcast. I've been told by my publicist to name drop as much as possible. That's not true. I have no publicist. But Kyle and I, since he no longer lives in Chicago, we record only once a month. We literally spend our warm up probably talking for about 5 minutes, and then our opening, you know, for the show, just literally catching up, which is the good thing about my favorite podcast, at least, is that that they, you know, the hosts, you have to really like, and part of it is you kind of feel like you're in the room with a couple buddies or, yeah, you know, whoever it is. So,
yeah. What's going on Biggest Fan? Cause I'm like at least one or two episodes behind.
We're still monthly. So if you're one or two episodes behind, you won't be long until you catch up. because of my wedding, we had recorded some beforehand. I had some technical problems. I don't know what you record on, Joel, and I know all the people out there who don't do their own podcast will find this very boring, but I use GarageBand, and I did not update it on my MacBook Pro, which, by the way, I went to an Apple store recently. They told me it's vintage, which AKA means they do not support or recognize this as a still working and viable computer, which is always great to hear. So basically, I'm using an 8-track computer because it's from 2009, and I hadn't upgraded the GarageBand other than the free upgrade support since I got it. So basically, I had iLife from 2009. That's what I podcasted on, and then I, for some idiot reason, decided, sure, I'm sure technology hasn't advanced so much that if I upgrade to the 2014 version that I won't be lost. Well, I was lost, and it took me at least almost a month of time just to sort of work out the editing on it. But anyway, we just posted Biggest Fan Super Smash Brothers, the Nintendo fighting game with all the all-star cast, you know.
Nice. Yeah, that's one of them that's in my feed. Like, I remember seeing that title.
Yeah, and it's a two-parter, so because apparently with the new GarageBand, you can't upload more than an hour and a half without it saying something like, uh-oh, we can't do this, which is absolute bull if you ever recorded anything, because I think the last time we talked, you know, we only had one episode of Game of Thrones, and we talked for an hour about geography and an hour about Game of Thrones, so GarageBand would not appreciate our verbiage.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mention all that, because I'm recording on the same computer, but I did catch wind of the new GarageBand not being great for podcasting. I can't remember whether it was Bill Meeks that gave me the heads up, or possibly my friend John Beck. Either way, I'm looking at it right now, And I use GarageBand 6.0.5, and I don't recall how old that is, but it's old. I think GarageBand currently might be 10. I don't know. It's new.
Yeah.
It's great for lots of things, but you know, for what I need and the templates that I have. And that's the other thing. I spend a lot of time kind of setting things up so that I can kind of record live to hard drive, bookend this thing with music, and then call it a day.
Yeah, don't think too much about it. Yeah, especially since for continuity of the recording, it's good to get into those rhythms.
Exactly, right? I also find that the podcasts that I enjoy and the personalities that I enjoy, because they're so busy and because the recordings are so authentic, I like them more. So that's usually my advice when people are asking me about, you know, podcasting and stuff like that. Outside of all the technical stuff, it's easy to tell people like what software I use and what mic I use and all that kind of crap. But the biggest kind of turning point for me with podcasting was doing a live to hard drive and just pretending like you're in front of a live audience, or in this case, like you are in front of a live audience, because the Citadel Cafe now does Alpha Geek Radio Live, which is, again, helpful. I mean, it makes you more accountable for being part of a, you know, a network and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the only thing that I would have a really difficult time with if somehow I couldn't use my current version of GarageBand going forward and I have to find something else. I mean, I use the Adobe Creative Cloud for all of my professional artwork. And that, of course, comes with Audition, which is their audio editor. And I'm sure that would be more than capable of, you know, editing a podcast and doing the things that I needed to. And it's that learning curve of like, you know, it's a professional audio program. Like I'm just basically pumping out an MP3 of me talking with friends, you know, like I need a music track at the beginning and it fades out. And then I need a music track at the end with a little ad in there at the start. Like that's it. It's not like I need, you know, multi-track editing.
You're not the morning zoo with like, we've got a helicopter.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's an elephant. You know, like you're mixers. Not dropping pans.
No. And I don't do, and even then, like my friends that have mixers, they're still doing live. Like they're using those mixers and those soundboards to put their bumpers and sound effects live into the recording.
Right. Yeah.
Not to go back and edit it afterwards. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Scott Johnson still does that. I mean, he's got that. He's a master of that stuff, but yeah I feel like
Garrett
the
does
same.
It too.
Garrett's excellent about that stuff too. That's why I'm always super envious if you have like somebody as whip smart as those guys who's also technically savvy, because then you have not only a radio personality, but you have a technician, which are two components that don't always go together, because I don't like to think of myself as very great or hilarious, but I'm a lot more of a personality than I am a technician.
A tech guy, yeah.
Yeah.
So who does the recording when you and Kyle do Biggest Fan? Is it Kyle?
He's always done it, yeah. We used to do it in person, so he had this really fancy mic, so we would cozy up to the one mic, but with two pop filters on it, so we're on either side of it.
Oh, cool.
And we would talk into that, and it was great because... I mean, the only thing I could ever say, if you can do it, record in person with other people, because there's a rhythm you get into that's fantastic. And I mean, they're fantastic Skype things. I know I listen to a lot of sports ones, and ESPN, the ESPN, which is, you know, a big American deal. They even record on Skype. But the shows where people are in person, there's an energy, a flow. You can tell when somebody's stopped talking. You can tell when it's appropriate to interrupt without chaos.
Yep.
And that was one of the best things about Kyle and I when we were able to do it in person. And so he records it, and then he just sends me the file, and then I edit it with GarageBand, throwing the music bumpers. I used to put, like, you know, track names. So you used to be able to do a thing on the iPod where you can like tap, you could jump chapters, so sometimes people could like catch up that way. And we had a couple guys who were like, they really like that. But then, you know, new versions come out, also you get out of rhythm with certain things. And so yeah, as much as it is close to live to feed, although we did that briefly on Biggest Fan, and then like two people wrote in and were like, we missed the bumpers, we missed these things, we missed the like little breaks, which is something I had borrowed lovingly from some NPR shows, like Wait, Don't Tell Me, where they add like a do-do-do-do-do, you know, like a music cue, and then it's, you know, back to the topic, but it, you know, it gives you at least a a nice bump point if you kind of listen to these things more at work or
commute. Yeah. It's also something that you do in artwork. You know, like if a piece of artwork is really, really busy and there's no place for your eye to rest, then it's not really regarded as a very good design. Mm-hmm. So you're not controlling the viewer's visual path as well as you could. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're looking at, usually it's like a 70-30 rule where you've got busyness taking over 30% and then large areas of rest for the eye. So kind of the opposite, I guess, for audio is that you'd want larger chunks of content, but then about 30% of, you know, or 20% of your audio, you'd want to have little breaks. And for me, it's just a matter of, you know, finding an edit spot and remembering at what point in the show we move on. I don't time the segments. Like I have a rough idea about mm-hmm. when we get through the intro and then move on to what we're watching, but I don't have a set timer. So I can't say 20 minutes into every recording is exactly when we move from one topic to the other. Sometimes it varies, especially when you get into like our Game of Thrones chats. I mean, God, that, you know, once that starts, you're just down the rabbit hole of what character you're talking about and for how long and all that.
Exactly. Kind of
stuff.
But yeah.
Speaking of, you know, going live to Hard Drive on podcasts and being very, you know, reality TV with it. One of the things that I watched this week was out of the San Diego Comic-Con that we did not get to last week because I don't think I actually knew about it. And that was the Muppets first look presentation. It's about 10 minutes. Did you see this?
No, but I don't blame you. San Diego Comic-Con might be the absolute most remote distance from you, maybe,
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But there was a lot of stuff online. Yeah. Last week, Lou and I were talking about all the stuff that leaked and all the things that you could catch. But this one, it starts off making fun of all the crap that went on with trailers being leaked. And there's this big kind of like Star Wars crawl of, you know, this was supposed to be an announcement that was exclusive to San Diego Comic-Con, but because you guys all moaned and groaned, we decided to release it anyway. And here, begrudgingly, is the first look at the Muppet television show.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's, so they really kind of tongue-in-cheeked it. But it looks really good. I'm not normally a reality TV fan. I was not a huge fan of The Office, which kind of makes fun of reality TV.
The mockumentary style, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's exactly what they're doing with the Muppets. So the Muppet Show is going to be an ABC television show, and what you're watching is the making of the Muppet Show, and that's what the show is.
Right.
And they do all these mockumentary stuff with the cutaways to, you know, the cheap gags and stuff like that. But they pointed out, like, Gonzo in the trailer says, "God, I hate that. What a stupid, you know, tool for jokes." And then they cut to him saying, like, "Wow, what a great idea." You know, like just, it's very kind of fifth wall or
fourth wall breaking.
Fourth wall breaking, self-exposed. It's got some celebrity guests, and they hint at that very early on. And there's a really, really funny part when Piggy is not on board yet for the show. This 10-minute trailer is basically playing like the story of how Kermit convinces Piggy to then join the cast of the new Muppet Show.
Yeah.
And so he goes to visit her on set. And she's doing like a war movie or something like that. And the character that she's playing is like a Civil War nurse. And the wounded soldier is Topher Grace. Is it Grace? What's his name? From the 70s show?
Topher Grace.
Topher Grace. So, you know, and it's revealed then that they have a relationship. And I actually laughed out loud when she referred to them as Tofiggy. As their hashtag.
That's great.
I thought that was pretty sharp. That I was rolling over for that one. And I mean, Gonzo and Animal are always favorites, and you know, they've got some fun stuff going on with Fozzie too. There was another laugh out loud moment with Fozzie. He's dating somebody and he's gone over to meet their parents, and she's a person. And of course, mm-hmm. they have no idea why she's interested in a bear, you know, like they're not treating him like he's some weird alien puppet or something. And they just treat him like he's a regular bear. And, they're worried about the kids. They're worried about, like, you know, where the kid's going to use the bathroom in the woods. And Fozzie, who's on the phone with Kermit in the kitchen, kind of leans out and just kind of cuts them off, just deadpan. "Hey, that's downright offensive, you know?" And it's the side of some of these characters that you haven't quite seen before. You know, it's like a little off camera stuff, and I think it's going to be really interesting. And I wasn't a huge fan of the Muppet movies. Did you see those?
The recent ones, you mean?
I love the originals. Name. I'm talking about the new ones.
I love him though.
Yeah, it's, what's his face there from
Save It for Getting Sarah Marshall?
Yep.
God, it's gonna drive me nuts. I'll Google it real fast. But yeah, I saw his film, and I did not Jason Segel. I didn't see Most Wanted because much like Star Trek films. Or at least the original series Star Trek films, where they were talking about the even number ones. I always felt like the Muppets would, like, there'd be a great Muppet movie and then followed by a bad Muppet movie, mm-hmm. because I feel like most of the A-team, and I don't know anything, I don't know any inside baseball on it, but I feel like the A-team of the like, creative minds would attack the first movie, and then they'd have another one in the pipeline, and then, you know, the B team, or like maybe some of the gags that were reused kind of land in that movie. So I was a little nervous about it. I heard it wasn't too bad. We have a friend up here who's a writer. He writes for a Consequence Sound website, which is like a music website. But he also has written for the AV Club. He does a lot of stuff, and he loves the Muppets. Like Dr. Teeth and Electric Mayhem are like, you know, if they could have played his wedding, he would have picked them over any band in existence. And he's a music, like, elitist, you know? He loves them so much.
That's amazing.
And
can you imagine having the Electric Mayhem play at your wedding? That would be amazing.
That'd be amazing. You know, and there would be that moment when Animal would just, like, lose it. Like, my absolute favorite thing is that the Muppets have done, and it's probably because I've seen it so much, is there's a Muppet, like, 3D show at Hollywood Studios, used to be MGM Studios, at Disney World. And because I went to Disney World so much, I saw them so many times. Anyway, there's a bit where I think they show, like, Animal, and he's just drumming, and he's so bored because he's just given such a simple part where he just does the one drumstick, and his eyes are half lowered. And then there's this moment where he just can't take it anymore, and so he rips out and he busts into his Animal stuff. Mm. There's just, man, the Muppets are great. So I definitely would love to see this. I didn't really have too much of a problem with The Office, although the dryness of mockumentaries, like the Christopher Guest movies, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, This is Spinal Tap, those types of films, usually doesn't get me very much because, and I don't know if it's just because there's something about the inside winking of a show within a show that sometimes can feel like, you know, like you say, sometimes it's just a little too much. It's a little too precious, mm-hmm. to be like, oh, we're doing a show, but we're talking about the show, but that is the real show, is how you, and, you know, and for some reasons that can feel a little too much. But the thing about the Muppets is they're just so unique that, I mean, they've done a Christmas Carol, a pirate movie, a heist movie. I mean, yeah. I would love to see a Muppet Western, you know?
That would be great. I would be on board for that. But what they need to do, I think, is just go ahead and make a movie. Like, just go find, don't try to figure out what's hot and what's funny. Just go tell a good story and make a comedy, you know, just make a good, like a good comedy spaghetti Western would be amazing. The thing that I found at fault with the Muppet movie, I haven't seen Most Wanted, but even from the trailer, I get the feeling everything just feels like they're behind, like they're trying too hard to be hip. They're making jokes that were funny last year. And it just sits like, wow, you guys are trying way too hard. It was the same with Jason Segel and his co-host there. I can't remember her name. Amy Adams, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, like it was not at all something that I felt was authentic. Like, it just felt very put on.
Oh, well, I actually really like it. The only thing I felt in that movie was put on was the We Built This City montage where they sing that.
Yeah.
That's really weird. But see, I also really love Brett, and I forget his last name, but he's one of the two Flight of the Conchords. He won an Oscar for doing the original songs from it. And A Man or a Muppet, to me, was just such a, like, it was really funny, and it didn't feel fake, because to me, what makes the Muppets the best are they're timeless. So I think what you're saying is your eye really gravitated toward the moments where it feels like this is topical, or, you know, this is not evergreen. You can't just, like, you can watch, there's very few jokes in, like, Muppet Treasure Island or Christmas Carol that make you feel like, oh, this was made in the 90s, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
So I think I can agree with you for a few things. I think the Rich Texman, played by Chris Cooper, his bit was really funny, but that's probably going to be one of the bits that doesn't hold up very well because it's very of the time.
Yeah.
So I could see that. But man, I've got everything that I need, that opening song, and then there's just really funny stuff. But also, to me, I'm not at a Jason Segel quotient of like too much. Like, I know some people are like sort of done with him after Forgetting Sarah Marshall and the success of How I Met Your Mother. So by the time like all these other movies come out, they don't care. But I didn't really finish out How I Met Your Mother, so he is still sort of in a good spot for me. But my favorite Muppet's Fozzie. So if Fozzie has plenty of airtime, I love Kermit, and I love Miss Piggy, and I love Gonzo. But you know, my favorite of the big four is Fozzie. There's just something about the fact that he limitlessly like still believes that there's a silver lining. There's like, doesn't matter how much his jokes stink, he still somehow goes out there and puts himself out there, and it still just lands like a dead fish. But it's so, it, just the way he reacts and his presence in that group is great to me. Yeah. I love the everyman, sort of the goofy Muppet Death of a Salesman type of, you know, everyman kind of guy.
So with Fozzie, what's funny about this trailer, because you'll like this trailer because he's in it a lot, and he's definitely going to be one of the main characters. He still falls flat with all of his scripted jokes, like all of his material for the show is going to be complete bomb. But the stuff that he says kind of sideways to Kermit when he's like leaving the boardroom table or the script meeting or something like that, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, he's funnier just being himself than he is when he's on stage doing the waka waka waka, you know, like it's just,
right.
He's looking for like the terrible pun, and you know, like he's saying like, ah, oh, Kermit, I'd love to help you out, but I've got to go home and change because I'm meeting my girlfriend's parents tonight and I'm really nervous about it. And Kermit just looks at him and goes, you wear a tie. And then and Fozzie just goes, ah, I'll walk then. Like, really, really, really good stuff. So it's moments like that I'm on board. I mean, and I really like Fozzie and Kermit too. I could take or leave Miss Piggy. I find that she kind of does it's kind of like a broken record with Piggy.
Yeah.
The gags are all recycled for the most part.
She's, at this point, it's...
Yeah.
She's kind of Urkeled of the series.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah. You need to pull her back a little bit more. Yeah. That's how I really felt about it.
Which they might do. They might
do
that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Although, did you see, in a related note, I also did not see it, but Rihanna's Bleep Better Have My Money, she has this epic R-rated music video for this song, as I already bleeped the first word of it. And then the Muppets, in great classic form, like they did with Bohemian Rhapsody, did a parody video of it. And it's really funny. Like, I kind of went back and tried to see a little bit of the Rihanna thing, but it's a little too much. I don't really watch a lot of music videos or keep up with that stuff. But the way the Muppets do everything, I'll just watch it. So it's really funny. And it's Piggy-centric, but like, it's Piggy in a way where you're like, okay, you know, I can take her in like a 5-minute intense dose and then give me the trio of guys for like, you know, a little while. And it's nothing to do with Miss Piggy being like, you know, the female or whatever in the group, but she just has that personality that's like the loudest person in the room.
Yeah. What's the name of that song? I want to make sure we put it in the show notes.
Bleep Better Have My Money.
Google will.
The female dog. So
that's hilarious.
Network TV in America, Joel, we can say that.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, you can. It's weird.
There's a lot of stuff that you can say on TV that you probably couldn't when I was younger too. I'm sure that Google will yield me that video. I'll throw that in the show notes too. Something that I've always liked about Animal, you're talking about the drumming. There's Rita Moreno was a guest on the original Muppet series. So way back in like the 80s, 70s potentially. And she's singing Fever.
Right.
And Animal is there. And all he's supposed to be doing is like this really light tap with like a ding on the triangle every once in a while. Like that's he's just doing like the ba-dum, 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 you know, like the slow rhythm, but he can't contain himself. And he keeps on like getting louder and louder and louder. And she keeps on having to interrupt her song and go over and like chastise him for being out of line. And she does it in Spanish and she just like rips him a strip. And he's like, it's almost like he listens to Spanish, but doesn't listen to English. Like it's really, really funny. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure it's on YouTube, but it's the Rita Moreno and Animal Fever. It's worth checking out for a classic. Yeah. I would say that's probably where it all started. You know, that gag.
Really, really cool stuff. Exactly.
Well, I know that one time, I think the last time you were on, you had mentioned that you were watching Sense 8. And I am also watching Sense 8. I'm just getting into it. I'm currently on episode 3, which I don't think I've started. I think it's just that I've finished the first 2 episodes. And you, how far are you? Halfway through, maybe?
I finished up the way my lunch has started. I'm halfway through episodes because I finish half and then I can only get to another half. Mm-hmm. So I got to episode 7 halfway through today. And I got to some really, really weird stuff. This is definitely a very, very strange series. There are multiple facets of this. Probably after I finish it that are able to be talked about. But for where you are in the series, I don't know how much I'm going to reveal. But I will say, I still don't 100% know what's going on, and I'm on episode 7. So, but like I said last time, when I just started it, I think I was where you are, episode 3. I really could care less about the sci-fi stuff. I really like the people and the actors. I mean, there are certain characters that are less interesting to me, but I like those characters mixed with other characters in different positions, but in somehow similar positions. It's really interesting. I mean, everything from like race to economics to sexuality to even there's a transgender character in the story. There's so much diversity to it that I really find it really interesting, these people and their situations. I think once it gets into a little bit more of the sci-fi action-y stuff, it's going to be really hard for it to land for me. But like we talked about with Lost as well, early on in that series, my favorite stuff were these stories about people and their weird, twisted backstories. Mm. But since then, the idea of the flashback in the episode has been brutally murdered to death, to the point where I hope Arrow never does them again, but I know they will. Yeah. But I've thoroughly enjoyed the actors and a lot of the concepts. I mean, they filmed on some crazy locations, and since people see each other, they had to move these actors like all over the world, or at least they fibbed it really, really well. So
yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about it with what level you've seen?
Well, I mean, so far, the first episode I felt smacked in the face by the weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like it felt forced.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, a great deal of that is simply my sheltered life. You know, like I don't have a lot of exposure to the world at large, you know, different cultures, religions, different sexuality situations and stuff like that. I mean, I've got some friends that are gay, but I don't know anybody in the transgender crowd, like I, you know, that I know of anyway.
Right.
You know, it's something that I'm, well, I mean, I can say I'm pretty ignorant to the whole thing. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I'm just, I don't have the education. That sort of realm. So I don't feel the authority to comment on it either way. I find it interesting, the show. I don't necessarily find it entertaining yet. It's almost like a documentary. You know what I mean? Like the first couple of episodes, they kind of grab you with the characters, but the weird is so overpowering that it's more of like a, I really kind of want to know what's going on, not for the fact that I'm, you know, enjoying the show. I'm just more curious. Mm-hmm. And I find myself with a break, you know, at dinner time, like you said, or at lunchtime, I'm not always in the mood to watch the next episode.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Whereas other shows like, I don't know, Hell on Wheels, you know, I'm just raring to see what happens next with Cullen Bohannon. Like, is he going to shoot the bad guy? I want to know. And with this show, it's not the case. I feel very similar to, I'm blanking on the name, Walking Dead. Because Walking Dead did a very good job of making me feel very anxious. Uh-huh. And if you've got other stress going on in your life, it's not an easy thing to sit down and watch that show. It really kind of puts you on edge. And I stopped watching because I just can never get in the mood to start it. When I'm watching an episode of The Walking Dead, it's a good show. I really enjoyed it, but I never am in the mood to watch it, you know? I think that's one of those situations where it would be a better experience for me if it was on TV and that was the only way that I could consume it, right? Like if I had to be on the couch at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night to see The Walking Dead, I would probably watch it anyway. Whereas now I can buy the DVDs, I can rent it, I can watch it on Netflix when it gets around to it. Like I'm not in a situation where if I don't, I miss it. I'm so far behind now and so far out of the discussion that, I mean, I don't even know spoilers, you know, whereas with Sense8, it's not that it makes me anxious. I guess in some ways it makes me a little uncomfortable, but I don't look at it as a bad thing. I look at it as it's kind of challenging, you know, your sensibilities and stuff like that. But I do find the cinematography and the way that they're telling the story, at least it's intelligent. Like they're not smacking you over the head, you know, like a lot of prime time does. You said it was what, 13 episodes long?
I believe it's 13. Netflix has not yet realized that they can do less than 13, I don't think. HBO's thing is, you know, at least I think they realize is we tell as many episodes as we think is best generally for that series. So True Detectives are 8 seasons long. Game of Thrones are 10 seasons long. Other seasons they've had, I think Deadwood was 12 or 13. I think it was
around that.
But like, that's the thing is just like, and like Flight of the Conchords had like a weird thing. I think it was only like 6 or maybe 5, like just weird numbers. But I think it's just one of those things where they're like, they sit down, they talk to the creators and the people are like, look, this is what we have ahead of time. So here's what we're going to kind of measure it out. I don't think Netflix has that. So for that reason, I will say that up to the point I've seen, they haven't really like had a big, they've had a couple like drops of information, but there's still no real explanation from the first episode about the Daryl Hannah and the Saeed element of the story as much.
Wow, that's a Chicago, long time to wait.
I know, and the Chicago cop is pretty much the one who's sort of the most involved really at this point. And some of the other characters are, you have this sense of the evil authority that's hinted at early on. Are kind of closing in on them. But then there's other characters that are just outright just in perilous situations, but that seemingly have nothing to do with, you know, the Daryl Hannah inciting incident or this authority, you know, that's involved. So it's really just, and those stories by themselves I find really interesting because they're not tied to the sci-fi as much. So
I really enjoy the Chicago cop, I don't remember his name, and the blonde DJ.
Oh, really? You like her? She is just...
Well, so far.
I feel like... Yeah.
I mean, it's only been 2 episodes. I mean, so far I'm at least interested in... I find her acting to be pretty good, and I find her story to be pretty interesting, at least thus far. It might be a little bit of a damsel in distress sort of feeling where like, I'm just, you know, I hope she's okay sort of thing. Like that's kind of where I am with her. The East Indian lady too. I thought that was kind of
she's really interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting. And it was fun. Like that was the one story that was light. Like I'm guessing it's like an engagement dinner or a family kind of event where her and her fiance's families are meeting, and there's like a dance, like a music video type thing that happens. It was actually quite fun. You know,
yeah,
like,
that part was really cute. Yeah,
yeah, it was unexpected. In you know, in the first you know two episodes, that was the only bright moment. Everything else was pretty grim. Yeah,
my favorites. Well, my other big favorite is actually one of the other few comedic things, which is it's interesting why it's funny, which is the Mexico City actor, the Mr.
Human. Oh, yes.
Super actor.
Yeah.
Without revealing anything, his circumstances are presented in a very certain way, and immediately they kind of pull the rug out from under that. And that story I actually find really interesting. But again, coming from a theater background, like, you know, we all were like changing the same dressing rooms, females and males, you know, like sometimes people are just naked next to you putting on their clothes for a show, and then you go on stage and you fake a romance or you try and murder somebody on stage, and then 3 minutes later you're greeting your family and saying hi to your castmates. Like, you have a very strange outlook on how people can interact and stuff. So there are elements of the show that there's a big thing that comes up that will be interesting. I would like to see if you get there, Joel, and how you feel about it. It's a sexual thing. And even more so than I think at this point you've seen some, because some of the characters experience emotions together. So if somebody's angry, other characters might feel angry. So there's some characters that get turned on, so other characters start to feel turned on. Well, there's a fairly heightened, fairly R-rated thing later on that I got to today. And I'm at work, and I'm with my iPad, and I'm like, oh, God, please, God, nobody come. Like, I'm, like, angling it away from the door, like, of this empty office that I just sent to eat my lunch in. And I'm like, please, God, nobody come in right now, because it looks like I'm just watching something that is not appropriate. Yeah. But whereas it didn't feel extremely gratuitous, was in the sense that the Wachowskis, like, to me, Zack Snyder, who did Man of Steel, 300, and some other guys out there, are like people that I don't necessarily want to write my film, but they could make probably a really beautiful trailer or at least a really amazing looking montage. And really, with the way Sense 8 is built, it's a lot of like quick shots, dialogue that moves, the camera's always moving, which are very easy techniques, but like at the same time, they're interesting to me. And these characters are still interesting to me. So those two things kind of still engage me. Whereas, you know, if it gets into the Wachowski world of, you know, the great authority and this world is not what you think it is, that's probably where it's going to start to really go downhill for me. But I haven't hit that yet. So,
yeah.
So I'm okay. But it sounds to me, Joel, that you probably will peter out, because it's definitely not a show that's given any real strong answers right away.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give it a shot, only because from just to swallow my own words, like, I complain too much about Hollywood doing the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot say how different Sense 8 is, right?
That is
so
true.
You know, so I mean, if you were looking for something that is nothing like anything else that you've seen, check this out, because mm-hmm. I mean, we kind of glazed over the premise at the top of the show, but it's there, it's on Netflix, it's easy to explain. But there's a group of people on the planet that start to have a psychic link, and they start experiencing things together and seeing one another, hearing different things, like, you know, you'll swear that there's a knock at the door when it's somebody else hearing it, that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. But it's how they are slowly feeling like they're being driven crazy, from my point of view, at least in you know, the series 2 to 3 episodes in, that they're still at this whole, you know, more than the characters do, right? Like, you're just like, oh, I know what's going on. And right now, so it's all kind of like, all right, well, they all think they're going crazy. Whoop-de-doo, really, you know? So it's not gripping yet, but it's at least with the characters and with how many different stories there are, you only get so much information per episode, so it does kind of at least make you curious.
Right, yeah, it's definitely curious. Be careful, though. It is definitely a hard R, hard R.
Oh, yeah.
And even some people who might be used, it's not swearing as much as it's not even super violence, but there's definitely a lot of sensuality to it. It's sex and preferences and just general human connection, not only on a physical level, but on an emotional level as well, are very paramount to it.
Yep.
And so if that's something that interests you, or something you feel comfortable with, it's fascinating for that reason. But because, you know, this is a show that is not on network television or even cable, it's put all out there. They can do whatever they want. And for that reason, I feel like that's good. I will say the one thing about it is I haven't seen something yet where I'm like, oh, the stronger choice would have been just to go for it, you know, as opposed to being like the easy way or the PC way or the soft way. Like, they've pretty much gone fully into like emotional story, like even like just feeling, you know, like they're characters that are very obviously depressed and they're dealing with things. And there's this poor guy, and I'm so ignorant of geography, but he's in Africa, and he is such a pure spirit, and he's so, you know, he's so, he's got such a good outlook on life. But his mother is dying of a disease, and he has to just try and fill this van with people who will pay to be driven to the city every day from these outskirts. But like, emotionally, it's really crushing, like you're saying about Walking Dead. But that actor and the way he portrays that character with hope, it like, I want to see more of him. And I really don't want something bad to happen to him, because he's so, you know, you're just like, ugh, this guy, this is, you know, the diamond in the rough. This is a daisy growing out of a battlefield. You know, you don't want to see that crushed. But it's interesting.
There's a lot of very good actors. There's very few people where you feel like they're just reciting lines.
Sure. Yeah.
Like a lot of the times, the combination of like the cinematography, like you said, with the handy cam and the quality of the acting, you really feel like you're just following people around.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah,
there's only a couple times. Who's the guy with the East Indian guy with the long hair that's like appearing to people?
Oh, Saeed, from Lost.
From His Lost, name, yeah. So that's where I've seen him before.
Naveed Williams,
but
I think.
The lines that he delivers are pretty scripty. Like, yeah. He doesn't speak like a normal person. He speaks very like Obi-Wan Kenobi sort of stuff, which I find takes me out of it a little bit. But like when the cop is talking with his buddy, and when really the DJ, the other character that I'm kind of intrigued about, mm-hmm. her lack of dialogue. Like, she doesn't really say a whole lot. You're more kind of just getting into her mood and what she's into and how she's shutting out the outside world versus how the cop is trying to turn over every stone. Right. And there's kind of interesting ways that the people interact and stuff in the show. And it at least pulls you in that way with the quality of the acting. I mean, I really found the van stuff that you mentioned earlier with the Van Damme van and the Bat van. Like, that was another light moment and you forget the light moments are in there. It's just that they're overpowered by this really heavy, heavy stuff. So,
yeah, the characters. I will say, for anybody who doesn't live in Chicago, that sometimes they see stuff and they go, that's not like it. There is an episode where they go to a bar, and I knew what bar they filmed it in, and then later in the episode they named the exact bar, which usually doesn't happen. A lot of times if something's filmed in your hometown, they call it like McGinty's Pub, but it, you know, it's like Duels, like on Third Street, you know, you're right. Like, whatever. But like the sense of place, and I have a cop buddy, what they wear is what the cops wear. Like, they wear those full tactical vests just as beat cops, and they drive those giant Tahoe things because, sadly, there is a very bad element of gang violence and still a lot of violence in parts of Chicago. But, like, the where they filmed it. So that's what makes me blown away. I'm like, if they used real shots from Chicago in this, then I believe they're going to all these places, which blows my mind because mm-hmm. that means they filmed in so many unique and really – I don't want to use the word precious because it sounds precious to use it, but really like nice and exciting places to see on film, particularly in a sense that it's not all, like you said, there's a Bollywood moment in India, but like that's countered with a guy in Germany who's very dour. But like, it's funny because wherever you go, you kind of get a sense of a little bit of a different atmosphere and culture, which is still pretty interesting at this point.
Yeah, and they're not filming in Toronto pretending to be New York. You know, I mean, like they're or Vancouver or whatever. Like, you know, like if they're supposed to be somewhere, that's pretty much where they are.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It feels pretty authentic in that way. Well, one of the things that we don't often get a chance to talk about on the show is what we're reading. And the last time you were on, I remember that you had mentioned or were going to mention some comics and stuff that you were into, but we have time this week. So what is on your comic nightstand?
The comics, I don't get a lot of single issues. I would love to do it, but I'm somebody who, like a Netflix queue, would probably not read them right away and then feel like they're homework. So I get trades, and that's pretty much where everyone's going nowadays. Unfortunately, for a lot of great comic artists, you know, the single issue sales are not super up there. But because of that, I really like to support really great writers and creators that are creator owned books. There's a writer, Rick Remender, who does stuff for Marvel. I'm blanking on some of the stuff he's done for Marvel, but he has some creator-owned stories that he's done, one of which is completely over. It's called Fear Agent. If you're a sci-fi, like cowboy sci-fi kind of person, you know, like the Scoundrel, the Han Solos, the Mal Reynolds, the Malcontents, that kind of just... like a private detective, just bounce from job to job, just want to keep fuel in the tank and coast on booze and whatever they can find. This series is for you. It's not really linear. There's a lot of like weird time jumps and stuff, and they talk about stuff without giving you exposition, which I appreciate now because it's not like, don't burden me with your world and then drop me in it. Like, just drop me in it and I'm smart enough, I'll pick up on it. And you start to see these things, and the main character, Heath Huston, which is just a great freaking name, he just wanders about the stars. And the artist is Tony Moore, who is fantastic. I love the way he draws. Is sort of my favorite kind of comic art, which is pseudo real but very cartoony still. So the human beings have proportional bodies, but their faces still have a little bit of a cartoonish kink to them.
I'm familiar with his stuff. I didn't recognize his name, but I just did a quick Google image search, and I've seen his stuff around for sure.
Right. And I think he's done some really popular stuff, you know, like on his own. I'm trying to think of something else that Tony Moore would have done. But yeah, if you just Google image his stuff, you'll have seen. Oh, well, he's famous for doing the Walking Dead comic book with a Kirkman, which to me, Fear Agent's a breath of fresh air. I read the Walking Dead comics up until, I guess I can't even talk about it, even though they pass it on their TV show, I know. But anyway, up into a big major physical location they get to that was really popular. I read up into that point in this really epically bad character that's involved with that location. And it was so crushing and so like drab. I was like, I'm done. I'm not going to read this. I've literally forced myself to read something I don't like for like 7 trades. So I have nothing. But the art was great. And to see that in a sci-fi space western private detective down his luck type of character is right up my alley. I love it. I did a Edge of the Empire role-playing tabletop game, and I built my entire character off of this character. I ripped it straight off of Fear Agent. Even my character sheet picture, I was like, I'm just going to use Heath Huston. awesome. I'll just name him Hess Buckler, and he'll just be a slow-talking southerner from space. He just kind of wanders from place to place. And that's what it is. So Fear Agent is finished. I kind of went over a certain period of time. Rick Remender, the writer, did that with Tony Moore. And you can kind of find it in trades. It's one of these things, though, that's really, it's kind of hard to find. It wasn't super, like, popular and pushed out at that moment. I think it was eventually picked up by Image, I want to say, was the company that did it. But the way I read it, maybe it's not Image. Oh, it's Dark Horse, and then eventually Image. They kind of have these giant omnibuses of it. So I just was like, screw it. I'll just buy one used you know, I think they sell normally for $50, but it was on sale for like 32. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'll just buy it because I read the first trade, and to find the other ones is going to be too difficult. And I loved it. So now I got to get the other omnibus so I can finish the series. But the first one was excellent. Not dumbed down. It is adult. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it's, you know, 100% for any age group. Maybe if you have a 13-year-old that watched like Terminator 2 Judgment Day when he was 10 years old like me, you probably could get away with it. But it's good. And two series he has that are ongoing currently that are creator owned. One's called Black Science and one's called Low, L-O-W. And both of them are sci-fi books as well. And Black Science is drawn again by somebody that I freaking love. The artist is Matteo Scalera. And again, cartoony, but with an edge of reality to it. And it's basically like Lost in Space. There's a family. They're traveling through dimensions instead of through space. Parallel dimensions where, you know, every possible, you know, outcome of any decision ever is replicated in a dimension. Mm. And they're dimension knots. They kind of are stuck with this device that broke. And for undisclosed amounts of time, it could be a day, it could be 2 hours, it could be 2 minutes, this group of people are by this pillar and they're zapped from dimension to dimension. I only read the first trade of this on my honeymoon, which is nothing about the quality of my honeymoon. We were just by the pool. And and I read this and I was just like, I was on at a pool by a lovely Costa Rican beach, and I just read it and I was just like, this is just freaking the life, man. This is a great book. It's beautiful to look at. I'm next to my wife by a pool. Like, this is great. And I really highly recommend Black Science. And Low as well, which is just basically about the sun's gotten too hot, so we live underwater into ocean cities.
Oh, cool.
And now there's only really one surviving ocean city because human beings, after a certain amount of time, get lazy. And then they get decadent. And it's basically like ancient Rome, where people stopped inventing, and so now there's a city that's desperate for air, literally, and supplies. And so there's this one family, it's another family story, where the mom is like, you know, we have to go try and find the other lost cities under the ocean and try and figure out a way to leave our planet finally. And that one is also beautiful. Just pairing of great writer with artists. Greg Toschini is the artist on Low. All three of these comics, I mean, the writing's top notch. You'll see a lot of themes if you read these three with Remender. There's a lot about regret, family, what it means to lose somebody, you know, what it means to be the one lone voice in a crowd that's going the opposite direction. Which is great for sci-fi because that's pretty much what we've always used sci-fi as a guise for explaining something about our world that might not be palatable if we just say it outright. And I think in all three of these comic books, it got really intense here at the end, but they're all very funny. They're all really dark. There's definitely a lot of, there's no fear of people dying in these comic books. So if you have favorite characters, just be prepared that it is a intense and mature story, so people can die. But I love all three of those. I highly recommend, if anything, Joel, just freaking Google images from these things because they are real, real gorgeous.
Oh, that's what I've been doing the whole time that you've been speaking. I mean, like, I've been going to the wiki articles and stuff like that. I think Fear Agent is probably the one that draws me in the most as far as the main character. It just sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But oh gosh, I blanked on his name already. The Italian artist that draws Matteo something? No.
Oh, Matteo Scalera?
Yeah, Scalera. Scalera's work is really nice. Just looking at some of his Google images and the book itself looks nice. The story that you're talking about, the Black Science. But yeah, his like Wolverine and Batman pinups and there's some Poison Ivy and stuff in there. And oh man, yeah, the guy's very, very talented. I think
he's real good. Yeah.
Yeah. The Joker as well that he had going on was very, very cool. So I love, it's not so much a trend, but it's more of a admiring the skill of comic book artists that use a very, very fine line in some of their work. Like there's big bold areas of blacks. Like there's, it's really well composed, good spot blacks, but the draftsmanship behind using a really thin line accurately and, and to do, to use it properly, it's just, it blows my mind how talented you have to be to do that. Like, I mean, my comics tend to have a, like a thicker cartoony outline, and it's mainly because it masks a lot of mistakes and makes things a lot easier. So if you're, but you're, if you're drawing, especially not a cartoony thing like what I do with Starcross, but if you're drawing like the human face and it's meant to be cartoony but expressive, like the anatomy still has to be there, but then to use like a really fine pen to do it, I find really, really sells it. There's a, Frank Cho is really good at it too, where he'll use like a really, a heavier line for like, say, a woman's hips and thighs and legs. But then when it comes to like her nose and her lips or her neck and her shoulders, he'll use like this really fine line and any kind of inside lines too, like musculature or anatomy and stuff like that. It's just this wonderful kind of play from one to the other. And it, it takes a lot of control, and, Scalera obviously has that, that going on.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, you're going to get me in trouble with my wife. She sees me looking at Google Images of Frank Cho.
Frank Cho,
it's,
yeah.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. He definitely draws the female body.
Yeah, you don't want to do that at work. You don't want to do that at work, unfortunately. He's done some very PC things, and he's also done some very risque things. I've got a book called Frank Cho Illustrator that he put out a few years ago. And it's basically all the stuff that wasn't mainstream comics. Like it's just kind of like his own, like very, Frazetta inspired kind of space odyssey stuff. And there's a lot of nude ladies and there's a lot of like space dildos and like, it's really, it can be pretty vulgar, but I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of like, I want to draw a naked lady in a space helmet with an alien tiger. And like, that's it. It's just, it's that very kind of posed sci-fi 80s thing in black and white ink. It's beautifully rendered, but you just kind of like, the subject matter is just like, yeah, I think Frank just wanted to draw boobs, you know?
And he loves tigers.
Yes. Well, and he does it. I mean, and I would say like, you know, big cats, hard to draw. The female form, hard to draw. Like the guy, he's got chops, you know.
Yeah.
He's a very, very intelligent guy. But it, as time has gone on, you know, his subject matter has gotten more and more risque. And maybe that's just because he's comfortable. He's like, hey, no, I can do this. I'm an artist.
I know
like,
where I am.
Yeah.
I know what, you know, what I do that works really well.
What I found Frank Cho was when I was reading Liberty Meadows, which is a comic strip that he used to do back when he was in university. And it's hilarious because it's, I mean, he basically went close to R-rated and then had to dial it back to get it printed, right? So, I mean, the jokes are like on the cusp of being just really, really offensive, which means it's hilarious. But it's very cartoony. Like he's got, there's a pig and a frog and a bear and a couple of humans. And yeah, it's a very unique comic strip. You can read them all online, but you can also buy them in a trade. Like you can find it at your local bookstore and just dive through. I'm sure $20 or $30 will buy you the full collection of Liberty Meadows. It's a really cool comic strip to check out.
Yeah. Nice. It looks really good too.
On my nightstand, I've actually been reading, surprise, surprise, Warcraft stuff. I mentioned last week that I've been back into playing the game, and what I'm reading right now is called World of Warcraft War Crimes by Christy Golden. It was recommended by Jocelyn and a few other people, and it basically ties into the bridge between the Mists of Pandaria and the events at the end of that expansion with the Siege of Orgrimmar, which is the capital city for the Horde, and then bridges into the Warlords of Draenor, which is the expansion that I'm playing right now. And Garrosh Hellscream is the warlord that's being put on trial. So this book centers around the trial. And it's interesting because no one is refuting that he's guilty. They all know what he did. They all know he was the one that did it. And they all know that it's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. But there's in Pandaria, which is kind of like this, I mean, it's a lot of Asian influence, but it's a very neutral kind of zone. They're not
Pandaria
necessarily
being the panda place.
Yeah, being the panda place. I know, very original name, right? But so there's Kalimdor, and then there's the Eastern Kingdoms, and that's where the Horde and Alliance are. And they've come to Pandaria kind of on neutral ground because Pandarans are both Horde and Alliance. It depends on which Pandaren you talk to as to what faction they've sided with. Whereas on the other continents, the factions are separate and they're separate by races. Like if you're a troll, you're a horde. If you're a human, you're alliance. There's no human horde guys. Like it's very divisive. So they're trying to hold a trial, not to determine Hellscream's guilt, but to determine how severe his punishment will be. Like, is it going to be death? Is it going to be life imprisonment? If it's going to, like, what's going to happen? I mean, most of the people are calling for his head, given the things that he's done over the course of his career as the war chief of the Horde. But what's really cool, and what just happened in the first few chapters, so I'm only about a half dozen chapters in, really good writing. Christy Golden is really impressive. A lot of names that I recognize, a lot of people that, you know, you kind of report to in the game as they kind of take you on in your quest, like leaders of different factions, you know, like the head Night Elf and the head Jaina Proudmoore, the, you know, one of the head Frost Mages for the Alliance.
I know
like,
her.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, I mean, if you're playing Heroes of the Storm at all, you'll recognize a lot of these characters. You know, Malfurion is in it.
Malfurion.
Yeah, there's some dragons and stuff that are in there. It's very, very cool. However, just playing finished Pandaria like last year, there's some aspects, some spiritual leaders and stuff from Pandaria that are in there that are also very cool. And nice to see them kind of represented, having been so fresh in my memory. But what's happening now is the Bronze Dragonflight, which I believe is the people that guard time, or the dragons that guard time. What they're doing is they've revealed an hourglass that will basically present like video evidence of Garrosh's crimes. So they're going to be putting Garrosh on trial and reviewing all the different things that he's done over the years that make him such an evil son of a bitch. So it's awesome as a book to just kind of get in there quick and get a reminder of the stuff that happened like in the game from like 6 or 8 years ago that I don't remember and that you can't go back and see because in some cases the world has changed and it's no longer there. You can't do that quest anymore. So it's going to be a really cool review for me. It's a neat kind of magic way of presenting evidence in a fantasy world that doesn't have technology like we have today. And just, I'm really curious to see where it's going to go. I'm liking, you know, the character development. The characters are bang on from what I can kind of gather from what friends have told me and what I've experienced in game. There's a couple of people that I don't recognize that I have to go, I still haven't done it yet, but I still have to kind of look them up on Wikipedia to kind of figure out, oh, wait a minute, who's that? Like, is that someone's sister? Or I recognize that name, but I don't remember whether they're an elf or an undead. And it's a little confusing because sometimes when someone's talking, I'm not sure if it's Horde or Alliance at first when they're all in the same room. So I have to kind of go and look them up and see what's what. But there's some really cool things happening. One of my favorite races in World of Warcraft, and it's, which is surprising because I'm not one of them. I play a blood elf in the game, but the Tauren, the great big kind of bull looking characters.
Yeah, I love Minotaur people.
Yeah, they're very, very cool looking. And Bane Bloodhoof is the leader of the Tauren. He's the chieftain and he's got a major role as he has been chosen to defend Hellscream in the trial. So the book is focusing on him a lot right now as this has just been kind of revealed. And I really enjoy his character. I really enjoy kind of like, he's got the Tauren people have got like a very spiritual, like almost like a Native American connection to the environment. So it's very, very cool to see all that kind of stuff happening. And if you're at all interested in World of Warcraft, even just to kind of get a glimpse into the world, I actually would say like, hey, why not? I mean, if you like crime novels, try something a little bit different. You know, you don't necessarily have to be someone that plays the game, or if you haven't played the game in a long time and you kind of want to see what's going on, I feel like this book is going to give you a recap. You know, I don't think you're going to be lost. I think there's going to be enough between that and looking up something on Wikipedia that you might not really remember. I think you'd be pretty safe.
You'd be safe. Yeah. I don't read a lot of tie-in things, even though I love some stuff, unless they start off as books like Harry Potter or Game of Thrones. But I grew up playing a little bit of Magic the Gathering, and I found myself fascinated by some of the flavor text, which hints at a greater story. Mm. So when I was going back, I found these books, and I'm a sucker for airships. Like, freaking airships are freaking awesome. So there's this crew, and they're a mismatched crew, and there's a Minotaur on the crew. He's sort of the gruff Worf of the group, you know. He's sort of the first mate, but he's the toughest guy. And I just read those books and devoured them more than ended up with the cards now. And like, as an adult, it's one of the few things that I can, like, of my middle school self, I brought back up to Chicago. I was down there and I was like, I can't bring myself to get rid of this storyline because it's only six books. And, you know, it's got the Magic the Gathering logos on it. It's very clearly in the same section that the Forgotten Realms books are, and the Dungeons and Dragons, you know, same with World of Warcraft and Star. I read StarCraft books, a couple of those, because one came with the old StarCraft War Chest or whatever when you used to get them. But I read those and legitimately, and I know sometimes people like are tentative about that sort of stuff. If it's not an adaptation directly, if it's something within that world, like, you already love the world, why not take a stab at it? Like, you know, I know they've wiped the canon clean, but for years people loved the Rogue Squadron stories, you know, Shadows of the Empire and the Star Wars. I've read
those, those are great.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'm sure you in particular might feel a little sour that they've sort of been like, okay, those are very sweet, but those don't matter anymore. But yeah, no, this sort of stuff is always really fascinating to me because it's like, yeah, I love this game. Like, I love the Borderlands video games. I love the humor of it. If if I found out there was a written book series, I really doubt that it would translate very well, but I'd take a stab at it because, you know what, I love the world. I'm in it for, you know, sure, I'll read a beach novel for like $5-$10 or whatever and just test it out. So that's really cool. I'm glad that that it ties in enough, but while giving you a little bit, you know, a little something special, a little something extra you can't get from the games because obviously, you know, they have to be action oriented. It can't just be political. You can't have a trial sequence as one of your missions in World of Warcraft.
And I think too, the problem with World of Warcraft is that the lore is really, really deep and the backstory is really, really deep. But in the gameplay, it's really just surface level. Like the stuff that you get, it's just exposition. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, like, I hate this character because he killed my father, blah, you know, and it's, but instead, like, when you're reading a novel, you get the internal monologue of that character. You get the pain and the memory and all that kind of stuff that they just, you can't do really well in Warcraft. And I find that the in-game cinematics are, I don't want to say weak, but they're very flat and to the point. Like, they don't they propel your questing forward. They don't necessarily steep you in lore. There are some quests that you can read up, like you can read, you'll, like, your reward is like a tome that will then tell you the story of how this character came to be and stuff like that, and that's really cool. But I, you know, you have to be really into the game to catch all that kind of stuff, and I'm a very casual Warcraft player. Like, I, you know, once a week, you know, I in for an hour or two and enjoy myself, but that's really all I have time for. So I'm not a completionist. Like, you know, I haven't done all the different quests, but right now I'm killing a lot of ogres and cyclops, which is fun. Yeah. I have to say the bat. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like the myopic sons of bitches, the Draenor area that I'm in right now in Warlords. I have to say the monster designs, the bad guys, like, I'm not running around really killing spiders or wolves like you used to. I'm in a place where, like, these things are big, ugly, mean, and trying to kill me. And it's cool. I actually died twice questing, which is unique. Like, normally when you're questing in World of Warcraft, it's not usually that hard. There's a couple times where I actually wasn't paying attention to what I was doing, and I got clobbered. So it's good. I'm happy. You know, twice in an evening. That's enough. That's enough to say, like, okay, Joel, you got to pay attention. You have to use your skills. You can't just phone it in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Stop punching the clock, you alliance, yeah, paladin monster man, whatever you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Actually, I'm a paladin. I'm a blood elf paladin. It's funny. I'm like, it's like a waify. It's picture like a blonde ballerina on steroids with a club. Like, that's basically basically what a blood elf is.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, not so much. I do a lot of twirling. yeah, I'd much rather. There's an opportunity in the game to boost a level 90 character to get them pretty much to where I am. And I'm debating now as to whether I want to continue with my character that I've played for years and years, or if I want to just boost to Torn and have like a house with shoulder pads to walk around and bash things with. And that's
heck yeah.
Yeah, I think I might be leaning that way. But anyway, we'll see.
When we did World of Warcraft on Biggest Fan, for years I loved the idea of paladins. But then I was like, you know what? I think I originally, way back when, I didn't have the internet or the money for it, so I tested a little bit of paladin. But then for Biggest Fan, like 3 years ago or something like that, I just played a tauren. And I really loved it. I generally love the hulking barbarian, but I play in a D&D campaign where, because my friend runs it, and for some reason, he thinks I'm very funny. I made a joke once that I feel like it'd be better if Minotaurs in some, fantasy stories or more British proper colonialists, not the sort of like, what, all that, so stuff, but more like, yes, it's for the queen and country. Yeah, it's kind of like Sam Eagle, but if he was British, it's the British word, like that sort of thing.
Nice.
And if they sipped tea, and this guy, if you ever saw Full Metal Alchemist, again, borrowed very heavily from it, but there's this character that is like, loves his, like, the beauty of his muscles, and he's always tearing off his shirt. He's, you know, Major Louis Armstrong. He's the, you know, and he punches everything, but he has to tear his shirt off to like have the little glinty diamonds and like wink at the camera, and then he flexes and then he just is like boom 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 boom, you know. So I just made that into Minotaur. So for that reason alone, I just absolutely love Minotaurs. Not to say that that's in the least like World of Warcraft.
No, yeah.
But
if you were a Torn in World of Warcraft, what class were you? Druid, shaman, warrior?
I definitely was whatever bashes the most bash stuff.
Probably a warrior then.
Yeah, I think so. I think when I looked at this stuff, I was like, warrior is generally more my style actually than paladin, because paladin's a little bit more defendery than, you know. Yep. Most of the times I realize I just get bored if I have to like a wizard, gorgeous. And sometimes when I played wizards in like fantasy video games, it's about my third playthrough, but my first instinct is I just give me a guy who simply all I have to do is think of two things: when to hit and when not to hit. And that's all I have to do. And then just throw me at it. And I will role play the heck out of it. I will make that character as rich as you could ever imagine. Like, I'm not just like, you know, me am ugh. But like, you know, there'll be some existentialism to it. But I'll make him a British Minotaur. And even though he punches things with his fists, he will be very polite about it and adhere to the Queen's rules of English and decorum.
That's hilarious. My D&D character is, what are the dragon races? Are they called Drogon or?
The Dragonborn?
Dragonborn, yeah. Yeah. So he's it's a 6.5 foot, 300-pound Dragonborn, red Dragonborn. Yeah. Like, just, I carry a 10-pound sledge. Like, you know, like,
yeah, exactly. It's just,
you know, if it moves, I can kill it, essentially, was the mentality when I rolled that character. I mean, I did it for a group of friends that invited me in kind of like that night. So like, I rolled a character right before, and I went simple, 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 but it made it more fun, you know, just like, I didn't have to worry about anything. Like, I could get in there and role play, and it was good. It was a fun time. I wish I had more time. I would have kept it up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great though. It's
well, that takes us into the Internet Minute, which is, of course, brought to you by tweakedaudio.com. For high-performance noise-reducing earbuds, visit tweakedaudio.com and use the code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. And it's very fitting that Tweaked Audio is sponsoring the Internet Minute, because it's all about radio. Alpha Geek Radio, which you may recognize as the streaming service that the Citadel Cafe uses, has an Indiegogo campaign up for a streaming media server upgrade. If you just, you can follow the link in the show notes, Alpha Geek Media Streaming Server Upgrade on Indiegogo, and check out some of the reward levels. Check out the video by Todd Whitehead, who is the guy behind Alpha Geek Radio, also known as Gnomewise on Twitter. You may recognize his avatar. Actually, I drew it. He's a great guy. He's really smart and really kind with his time for podcasters that are learning how to do live streaming and want to get in and be a part of, say, like Alpha Geek Radio. He's super helpful. He wants to put more into the network, but it's also, you know, obviously a lot of time and energy and money, you know, on his part to do that. Right now, the bottleneck is really just the fact that the server equipment is expensive. And in order for him to help kind of retrofit everything, which is something he's doing through Doghouse Systems, which is actually a former client of mine, he's going to be able to use this Indiegogo to then put the money towards the new servers. And it'll allow, as he puts it in his video, people like me and people like other podcasters on the network to then upload their content and then have it go to any number of services. So rather than me having to like upload my stuff to all kinds of different places to get it out there, Alpha Geek Radio and Alpha Geek Video will kind of help podcasters that want to distribute their content even farther do that. And there's a number of really cool rewards. Hammond and Daryl, who do the Grumpy Cast, they are doing a custom Grumpy Cast with a couple of guests. One of those is already taken. I offered to do a one-of-a-kind commission. So if you back at the $85 level, you'll get an original 9x12 black and white piece of art from me, something that I'm doing to help Nomoise kind of hit his goals. Right now, he's only 2 days into a 30-day campaign, and we're at 10%. So check out Alpha Geek Radio on Indiegogo. Check out our show notes for the links, and hopefully we can get Alpha Geek Radio over the hump for their campaign, because I think it's going to be really, really cool to have this available for everybody. And even if, you know, like, there's a lot of reward levels that have like a kind of a mail out or something tangible, like being a guest on a show. Even if you just want to contribute a dollar, like, I mean, if you take your dollar and you spread it out over however many shows you possibly listen to on Alpha Geek, it really helps everybody. So tell your friends, you know, tell people that are listening to Alpha Geek Radio shows, and see how many people we can get in there and help make this happen.
Sweet. If I dropped $85, you have to draw a Frank Cho version of like the barista or something like that. She could just be reading, like making a nice cup of coffee with a tiger and like a hammock. But yeah, that would be my like mandate. $85, something I could, of course, never hang anywhere. Well, not to say I couldn't be hanged, you know, beautiful art and stuff like that. But that's great. That sounds awesome. You know, and yeah. I mean, the great part about podcasts is, and the internet in general, is being able to reach out and find people who have tastes like yours and interests like yours. And
yeah,
anything that helps get that out there sounds awesome.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun campaign. And a lot of the producers that are on the network are donating their time to do a special host kind of like one-off podcast about any given topic that one of the reward level people can choose, which I think is kind of cool. It's a kind of a nice incentive. Like, if you're into podcasting, you're supporting podcasts, what would be a really cool reward? Well, a podcast that you get to kind of like direct. Like, you get to say, I want this guy and this girl or whatever combination you have to talk about this topic and go, you know, I think it'd be a lot of fun. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on thecitadelcafe.com/live. As I just mentioned, our mobile audio stream is indeed provided by Alpha Geek Radio. Go to tunein.alphageekradio.com to find out how you can listen on your favorite audio device. Choose channel 1 at showtime for the Citadel Cafe. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and of course the episode will be available on demand and via iTunes on our website, thecitadelcafe.com. Email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. As I mentioned at the top of the show, my name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything that I am up to online at joelduggan.com. A big thank you, as always, to our 18 supporters on Patreon, supporters like Mr. Mike O'Day, who have been on this show a number of times. Speaking of Mike, if you're listening, when are you free next? We should have you back on. And if you want to go to patreon.com/Joel Duggan, that's where you can check out how you can support the Citadel Cafe, as well as my webcomic work on Starcrossed. Where can people find you online, Rocket?
Well, they can find me at joelduggan.com. I do some gorgeous art under a nom de plume. It's very good. I also work on the titles Mateo Scalera and Frank Cho. I'm just you could just find me at biggestfan.podcast@gmail.com. I'm in such a beat by beat rut that I just give our email. It's Biggest Fan Podcast. That's the name of the podcast. You can find it on iTunes and whatnot. And yeah, we just talk about whatever pop culture stuff. We did a 2-part Super Smash Brothers. Talked about the 64 game all the way up to the new Wii U version. Soon we're going to be putting out a Ghostbusters episode, which talks about the movies, the cartoons, the toys, and then what we know of the new film coming out. And then recording next week, we're going to try and do the Jurassic Park franchise. So we've been doing a lot of navel gazing, a lot of like retrospective new. Well, actually, all culture is pretty much recycling itself right now. So it's kind of nice because you get to talk about your favorite old stuff while talking about new stuff.
Yeah.
So we pretty much do that. I'm biggest fan.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.
I pick easy and easy because you can't ever have enough easy.